Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Hello there, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to Just Not Good Enough, a podcast that deals with mental health, particularly at work. I'm here today with Jeff McDonald, who used to be Global VP for HR at Unilever, I believe, Jeff.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You were there for, what, 25 years?
25 years, Chaz. Yeah, good old 25 years.
Wow. I don't know about you, but I love brands. I think brands are just the best thing because you can relate to them. You see them in the shops and so on. And there's something emotionally engaging about them, isn't there?
Yeah, and I also think that brands can be a force for good in the world, you know.
Interesting.
There are some brands
out
there.
In what way?
Well, if you take a brand like Dove, you know, I mean, Dove is a brand that is...
This is the pit spray thing.
Dove.
Is it?
No, Dove, the shampoo or the soap, Dove soap.
Do you not do Dove
Yeah, you do it as well.
There's deodorant. Okay, that's because my son uses it, that's all.
Yeah, but I mean, Dove is, I mean, you know, the campaign around Dove was all around helping and getting women to feel good about themselves, irrespective of, you know, what they looked like. It was more their inner beauty that was the important thing to recognize.
Wow, and is that where... that brand building started, if you like. So is that how, not the brands were created, well, maybe they were created like that, but there was something psychological about them as much as there is in a brand like a chocolate that gives you a treat.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my experience in Unilever was we went down this amazing journey or route where we rediscovered the purpose of Unilever, which was to be beyond growth and profitability, you know. So its purpose was to try and make sustainable living commonplace in the world.
How long ago was that?
So we started the journey with Paul Polman back in 2009.
That was really ahead of the curve, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
I know Unilever is absolutely ahead of the curve because otherwise it wouldn't be as successful as it is.
And that was, I mean, it was what transformed Unilever. Was this rediscovery of a sense of purpose. It completely transformed the performance of that organization. And what that led to was us to think about marketing and brands. I remember we used to have this saying, which was, you know, we are not marketing to consumers. We want to matter to people.
Oh.
We want to matter to people. And what that
I've got to record. This would be a recording of this. So cool. I want to write that down because I just think that's
so. Let's stop
fantastic.
Marketing to a consumer because a consumer feels like, no, we're talking about human beings that are using our brands. They are people. And let's matter to them because every single day there's so much data that comes your way.
I hate it. You know? And I hate the data. I hate adverts, actually, because all they're trying to do is get you to buy something.
There's all this data. So how do you create something that's going to matter to you that you're going to actually then, you know, take notice? And what that led to, Chaz, was that a move in terms of marketing from what you were just saying earlier, from kind of what are the functional attributes of a brand – to rather focusing more on the emotional attributes of that brand.
Yeah.
So, yes, Dove needs to lather when you use the soap and it needs to feel good on your body and the perspirant or the deodorant needs to last. Yeah. That's the functional attribute. But how do you create more of an emotional attribute that is going to matter to people who are then going to fall in love with the brand and want to use it?
That's hard, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, really hard. Anyway, look, I'm sure we're going to come back to that because in, what was the year, 2008?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was. So this is just before the your transformation in terms of the way that the business was managed.
Mm-hmm.
You had a bit of a breakdown, didn't you? Would you call it a breakdown?
I wouldn't call it a bit of a breakdown.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. That's typically English understatement. I do apologize.
I often call it
no way. How to insult your guest without, you know, intending to.
Yeah.
Talk me through that because these things don't happen like that overnight, do they? There's something, it works its way up and then something just cracks at the end. And so just talk me through that process because you'd been at Unilever for how long then?
Well, 20 years. So 2008, right. I'd been in the business for 20 years.
Right.
I was the global head of HR for our home care business all around the Unilever world. It was my crucible moment in life. I mean, that breakdown in many ways was my breakthrough.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before. That's so good.
It was my breakthrough. It was my breakthrough in life. But it was, you know, there was all sorts of stuff going on in my life at that time.
Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, no problem. I remember we were, you know, we got back from, I'd been transferred from the UK to Australia. I'd been working in Australia for about 3 years. We got back to the UK around about 2005, 2006, 2 years late. And I'd been on the kind of expat circuit for a good 10, 15 years.
I did that for 3.5 years. It's good fun, actually.
Yeah, it is
But it's bloody stressful at the same time. Anyway, carry on.
The amazing thing about being an expatriate was it gave you an opportunity to save an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
Well, no, not enormous.
But it's enough.
A fair amount of money. Education was paid for by
Or your mortgage or whatever.
You didn't have a house. You didn't have to worry about a mortgage. Yeah. The company was paying for all of that sort of stuff. So you were able to save money. Yeah. And what happened was, because I'd been an expat for so long, I remember Unilever introducing a policy which to say, you know, at a certain period, you need to come off the expat route.
Why localize. Why was that?
It was to save costs.
Oh, was it? It was not because of well-being?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's really just to save costs across the organization. I mean, there were hundreds of expats.
Well, there would be. In the
costing a huge amount of, thousands of expats.
Yes. Yeah.
Costing a huge amount of money. And so after a certain period of time, you'd come off the expat, you'd localize. And I remember, you know, that happening and thinking, jeepers, you know, now all this money that I've saved, I'm going to have to take it out of the bank, and we're going to go and buy a house, and we're going to put our roots into the UK, and, you know, I'm not going to be going back to South Africa. And
that's a big moment for you, isn't it?
It was.
Is your family South African?
Yes.
Okay. So that's for everybody then. It's a big moment.
Yeah. And one of my daughters had come back from Australia, and, you know, she was... She didn't want to in the first place. She was slightly dyslexic. She was struggling at school. I had a very stressful job. I was traveling the world. I wasn't sleeping as well as I should be because I was on aeroplanes all the time. You know, and there was just all this stuff.
Yeah.
And as you say, it all kind of hit me. And it, you know, the last straw to break the camel's back was midnight on the 25th of January, 2008, the night before.
Wow. You remember it to that level of detail?
Absolutely.
Because it's your breakthrough moment, isn't it?
Well, no.
Okay.
Because the 26th of January was my daughter's 13th birthday.
Okay.
And a 13th birthday is a big birthday because it's...
A teenager.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why I don't forget it. The 25th of January...
Of course, yeah.
2008, the night before Jennifer's 13th birthday, at midnight, I get woken up with a massive panic attack.
How does that feel? You see, because I get depression, but I don't get anxiety.
Jeepers. Well, a panic attack. I mean, first of all, I mean, the words panic attack were never part of my vocabulary. I don't think up until
depression wasn't part of mine, actually.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think I'd ever had a conversation with anybody about a panic attack. The ends of my fingers are tingling. The ends of my toes
physical,
are tingling.
As much as, oh, really?
My heart is beating profusely. I'm struggling to regulate my breathing. The bed sheets are wet. They are wet with sweat.
So you woke up like that?
It wakes me up.
So it's happening in your sleep.
The panic attack is what wakes me up. It's what wakes me up. And because I'm so naive to it, I think I'm having a heart attack.
Well, you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I think I'm about to have a heart attack. And I remember I bumped Debbie, my wife, and I said, Deb, I think I'm going to have a heart attack. And she said, why? And I tried to explain what I was feeling and experiencing, you know, these physical sensations. And the bed sheets are wet with sweat. And she said, what's wrong, Jeff? And Chaz, that was the beginnings of me then being diagnosed with anxiety-fueled depression.
And what did you then do for the next? Because you took some time off work, didn't you? How did you get through that?
Well, I couldn't.
How did work react to that?
Well, I mean, Unilever was amazing.
At that time?
Absolutely. It was incredible. I mean, Unilever has at its core, part of its DNA, the word care. I mean, Lord Lever, when he started Lever Brothers, up in Port Sunlight, he brought a bar of soap to the world because he wanted people to feel clean.
That's a pretty good, I mean, if you're building brands, what a fantastic backstory that is.
Yeah, and that was the purpose of Unilever back in the late 1800s up in Port Sunlight, you know. And that sense of care and concern is just part of the DNA of that organization.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was very lucky in a couple of ways. One, I worked for Unilever. Two, I had a line manager at the time. He was the global head of the home care business around the Unilever world. His name is Keith Weed.
So a CEO HR.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So yeah. He was the head of the home care business around the Unilever world. His name is Keith Weed. He had a compassionate relationship to depression.
How? Why?
Because he'd experienced it in his life.
He'd lost
a friend to suicide a year or two before. So he had a compassionate relationship.
But haven't we all had that?
What?
We all know somebody, these days at least, that we, you know, everybody has been touched by depression, either through their family, through associates, through friends, or just the fact you hear people, you know, celebrities or film stars or whatever committing suicide.
We're happy to say that now.
Oh, yes, exactly.
But back in 2008.
No, not a chance.
You weren't happy to say you had an association with depression.
No.
So I was so lucky with Keith that he had this compassionate relationship. So I worked for a company that cared. I had a boss that had a compassionate relationship.
No wonder you stayed 25 years.
Yeah, and they were amazing to me over those 3 months. I mean, I had to take 3 months of work. There is no ways I could be at work. My levels of anxiety were so high that I had no cognitive abilities. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't read a document and remember what I read because I was so anxious. And so, I had to take three months of work.
So basically, you were almost frozen.
Yeah,
physically as well as mentally.
I remember when Debbie walked into the bedroom. So you know, the panic attack happens. I can't go back to sleep. 7 o'clock the next morning, Jennifer comes running into our bedroom because it's her 13th birthday.
Oh God! Yeah, yeah.
You know, we have a tradition at home where we have presents on the end of the bed, and we all open presents together. No, birthdays, birthdays.
It's a good shout. That I'm going to write that down as
birthdays. And Jen comes running in, and Anna, who's 10 at the time, her little sister, comes running in after her. And I mean, all I can say is, please leave me alone. Please leave me alone. There's no ways I can engage in anything where there's joy, where there's excitement, where there's laughter.
You see, you're forgive me to interrupt you. I'm going to do a lot of interrupting, and it's perfectly okay if you want to interrupt me. But so you're in the midst of wondering what's going on with yourself.
Yep.
But upsetting your family at the same time,
yep,
aren't you?
Yep.
And I know what that's like, because when you're thinking about yourself, actually, I personally don't give a shit about the family.
Yeah.
I'm just not interested in anything else other than what's going through my brain. And is that...
Chaz, that resonates so much. It's so much. I mean, I remember when I was ill with anxiety-fueled depression, I was the most selfish git.
Why am I laughing? Honestly, because this is serious stuff, but I know it's exactly the same for me. I'm a selfish shit. I'm so difficult to live with when I'm going through a period of depression.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I began to build this real victim mentality. And
you as the victim.
Me as the victim. And why is this happening to me? And why can't I get better? And being impatient about it all. And it was all about me, all about me, all about me the whole time.
How does your wife, what's her name? Sorry.
Debbie.
Debbie. How does Debbie reflect on that period now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a very, very worrying and difficult period for her. And the worrying was because she was concerned about me. And the difficult period was she just didn't know how to care for me. And you know, we both know Alistair Campbell, right?
Yeah.
And his wife and his partner, Fiona, does this amazing program now, which is about helping people who are living with somebody who struggles with depression or anxiety, how to live with that person,
My wife needs to look at that, because I mean, I've caused her so much grief over the years, and not known about it either. Just thinking it's just the way I am, and I'm a miserable frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And interestingly, I'm sorry, just sidetrack, but I'm a trustee of the National Star College in Cheltenham, which looks after severely handicapped and profound complex disabilities, about 220 of them or something. And there's a nurse there, and I because every time I meet somebody, I always say I live with depression. I don't suffer with depression. I live with it. And she said, oh, so does my husband. And we had a chat. And she goes through exactly what you've just spoken about. She lives with a husband who, frankly, is not very nice sometimes. Mm. And I said, well, why don't you and he come on this show? And she's thinking about it. Okay. I don't think she will, actually. Because no. I think she might, but I don't think her husband will. And I can fully understand that. But you're right, it's the damage, not the damage, it's the impact you have on the people around you.
But I think it would be amazing to do a show where you got a carer on to talk about that.
Yeah.
And because there are so many people out there that are living with people with depression. And, you know, Debbie, she had no idea on how to deal with this.
Well, you don't. It's not, I mean, you know, if you cut your finger, you stick a plaster on it, doesn't it? And, you know, I think it was Alistair who said, you know, if you've got a broken leg, you can sympathize and so on. But if somebody's got a mental condition, you don't see it. You know, I mean, I can begin to recognize it now because you can see it in people's eyes sometimes. But, you know, the vast majority of the time, it's hidden behind a personality.
Mm, absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So you had your 3 months off.
Yeah.
But you went back to work, didn't you? Now, mm-hmm. you've got a very compassionate boss, which mm-hmm. is fantastic and inspirational, actually. Mm-hmm. How was that then different for you for the next, 6 years you spent there?
No, another eight. Six, because I left middle of 2014.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
because I mean, did people know that you, well, they knew you'd been away. Did they know why? And
yeah, some of my colleagues knew. Some of my colleagues knew.
But how did the company react to you? And the people that knew, how did they interact with you?
Well, I often say, you know, when I tell my full story, I often say that, you know, during those 3 months when I was off work, I had very dark moments.
I'm sure you did.
I had moments when...
Do you want to talk about one of those?
I didn't feel like living. I was a burden to my family, to my friends, and the world would be far better off without me. I had these dark, dark moments.
I'm going to be quite frank and open now, but I mean, did it go any further than just thoughts?
I never attempted to take my own life, but I had plans and thoughts on how I might.
I mean, I get those as well, and it's probably pretty grim to say it, but actually it would be really easy, I think, when you're feeling at that deepest, darkest moment, and the thought of not being here actually it's frankly, it's quite easy. A lot of people say it's quite hard to commit suicide, but I don't think it would be. And I've been very, very, very close to it, even to the point where I'd given up and had to be rescued. Carry on.
Yeah. But you know, when I was diagnosed with anxiety fueled depression, I made a decision not to be burdened by the stigma.
That's very early. It took me 4 years to get to that point.
Well, I had four things in my favor.
Okay.
Let me tell you what they were.
Okay.
The first was I had a diagnosis.
Yes.
Which
in
many ways liberated me. It kind of made me feel, okay.
Yeah.
A doctor has said that you're not well.
Yeah.
The second thing that was in my favor is my personality.
Yeah.
So I wear my heart on my sleeve, and what you see is what you get.
Yep.
Look me in the eye.
I am.
And you'll see if there's something going on.
Yep.
Not very good at masking.
No, there's a bit of a sparkle there at the moment.
Okay.
Yep.
So I'm not good at masking my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
The third, at the time, I was 20 years with Unilever, senior HR job, built 20 years of credibility. I wasn't a young manager coming in wanting to make a career and very ambitious.
Yes.
There's
an issue there as well, isn't there, which I'm sure we're going to get onto.
But there was 20 years of credibility in the bank.
Yeah, you don't suddenly turn into a duffer, do you?
Exactly. And the fourth thing that was in my favor was my compassionate boss.
Yeah, I hate to put those in order, but I'd almost say that that's the best one.
It probably was the most powerful.
Yeah.
Right? So those factors actually empowered me to make that decision that I was now going to tell my family, some of my close friends, and some of my colleagues at work. And why I'm telling you this Chaz, is because do you know what reaction I got from nearly every single one of them?
I know what you're going to say, but I'm going to let you say it.
The reaction I got was the most wonderful outpouring of the most powerful emotion in the world.
Yeah.
And it is called love.
Exactly.
Love. And so in my darkest, darkest moments, knowing that I had a 10-year-old called Anna who loved her dad, knowing that I had a line manager who loved me, I had some colleagues and some friends. So when you talk about how did people react to me coming back, it was a sense of love, a sense of support.
And was there anybody, sorry, I'm interrupting again, but was there anybody who sort of kept their distance a little bit? Just not because of any wanting to avoid you, but just because they didn't quite know how to talk to
was.
You?
Yeah, there was. There were people like that. And there was, you know, this is back in 2008. Stigma is still we're not talking about depression.
It's still here,
days.
So God, it must have been there then.
Yeah. So yes, there were people who were, you know, a bit, you know, why was Jeff away for so long? Is he okay now? You know, all those sorts of questions and walking a bit on eggshells, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I was, you know, I then did that job for another 2 years. And then I went on and did the last job that I did in Unilever, which was the global head of HR for all of our marketing, communications.
So actually, they promoted you.
Well, it wasn't a promotion. It was, I moved sideways. But it was into another big job.
You were part of... was it home care?
So I was the home care division.
Yeah, and then you became global for...
But that was global as well. So that, you know,
oh, right, but so the global was the whole business.
Yeah.
Well, that's got to be...
Well, I went into two big global jobs. The first one was the home care job globally. Yeah. And then I did this global job around marketing, communication, sustainability.
Ah, right, okay.
And I was the HR guy.
Okay.
And that's
okay.
Why I know so much about brands and
marketing.
Cool,
yeah, it's good.
Even
it's
although
good.
I'm an HR guy.
Honestly,
even though I'm an HR
actually,
guy.
I'm a finance guy and I love brands, but it gushes out of you.
Yeah,
I can see it.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just so, so fortunate. You know, a sense of love. And I'll tell you the other emotion that kept me alive in those dark moments was hope. So I used to meet with a colleague of mine every 10 days. And 2 years prior to me getting sick, he had been so ill with depression. He was hospitalized.
Wow.
And I used to meet with Martin every 10 days. And you know what I saw? I saw he was better. I saw he had got better. Do you know how much hope that gave me?
Yeah.
It just gave me that little bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
Do you ever, in your dark moments, I know I get a similar reaction to me about, you know, people that love you and express it. And even just to say, oh, you're looking really well. You know, that's an expression of love in many ways.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't hear it. I would just blank it out because the negative thoughts in my head were so powerful that I didn't believe them. I didn't hear what they were saying. I could hear it, but I didn't listen to it. Did you ever get to that point where you said you just...
No. There were many moments that I felt like that. But I... Do you know... I don't know how this is going to sound, but I said earlier that that for a large part of the time that I was ill, I had this victim mentality. And I'll never forget one evening. It was still winter, it was dark, it was raining outside, and I made a decision that night to no longer feel like a victim. I put a pair of running shoes on, and I just went and ran.
Have you been running before?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so you normally do things like that, right? But so it wasn't a suddenly, right, I'm going to go exercise.
No.
Okay.
I've always loved exercise, you know, so I do triathlons.
Well, you're
and all
South
sorts
African,
of things,
aren't you?
Know, so, typical, yeah. We won't go to the World Cup, right?
No, we won't.
Okay,
no.
Stay away from that.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Well, we might, actually.
Okay.
Particularly the last one.
Yeah. But, Chaz, you know, and I just, and up until that point, you know, because I was so anxious, you know, you spoke about, I actually was paralyzed by the anxiety that I felt. So I didn't feel like going for a swim or riding my bike. I just couldn't, or go for a run.
We're going to talk about energy, aren't we, later on?
Yeah.
We are, because you're very passionate about energy.
I am.
And you, frankly, didn't have any at that point.
None. And I couldn't, but I made a decision that night in the pouring rain, a wintry night, to just put my running shoes on and go for a run. And in many ways, that was a turning point for me, because it was a moment where I kind of accepted that I had this thing called depression, that I shouldn't be a victim mentality, have that mentality, and that the only person who was going to get me better was me.
Yeah.
The only person was going to be me who's going to get
you
me
see,
better.
You see, I mean, you're like, a bit like me, and we're both men, obviously, and we've been relatively, well, you very, me, relatively successful in business. And the macho side comes out of me quite a lot, particularly being in finance. And I rejected help for so long. You know, I don't need any help. I can do this. I can deal with this myself. And you do get to that point, don't you? Like you did. You just described it very well there of, okay, if I'm going to do this, I've got to do this. And funnily enough, people will help, still help you. Mm. And so what, you've had your diagnosis, you've done your three months, you've gone back to work. What did you do at Unilever then, knowing where you were on the mental health spectrum, to try and change the way people worked and the way the business interacted with itself, and indeed other parts of the world?
So again, you know, Keith had been the head of the home care division. And when Paul Polman was appointed the CEO of Unilever,
which is a year after you
2009,
said, yeah, a year after you were diagnosed,
sort of back end of the financial crisis, Paul joins Unilever, and we go on this journey about rediscovering a sense of purpose. So Paul decides that he wants to appoint onto the executive a chief marketing, communications, and sustainability officer, because the purpose was going to be linked to sustainability. The brands had to drive the purpose. You had to communicate that both internally and externally. So he wanted a single person to take on that responsibility.
How was that viewed around the organization? Because that's a game well ahead of the game.
Initially, it was like, what's all that
fluffy stuff?
And not only the organization, investors the same. You know, investors.
We might come on to that later.
I mean, come on, what is all this stuff?
Yeah.
Anyway, and he appoints Keith. And because I'd worked with Keith for 4 years in home care, Keith then says
ideal.
To me,
he sounds the ideal person.
He says, Jeff, come and be my HR business partner for this new role that I've got. And so I go off and I do that role. And one of the things about Keith was, you know, he really saw the importance of people and how important the right people in the right jobs was to the success of the organization.
And that's not just about technical capability,
is it? All sorts of things, you know. So, and one of the things that we had kind of begun to play with when we were in the home care division was this concept of energy. So, you know, he had inherited a business, the home care division of Unilever, that was a bit of a dog of a business. It wasn't doing very, very well. After 4 years, it was the most profitable one. Well, probably the margins were far better.
All down to the HR team.
But it grew like you won't believe. And we had begun to play with this concept of energy and how important the energy of our people. I used to be an HR guy, and people used to talk about people being your most important asset. We began to think about the energy of people is the most important asset.
Yeah, yeah.
How energized they are, how passionate they are feeling, the right kind of attitude to get their work done. And you can only be energized if you are healthy, physically, mentally, emotionally, have a sense of purpose and meaning.
What's the distinction between mental well-being and emotional well-being?
So emotional well-being, emotional is our feelings. It's how we feel. And we all have got hundreds of different feelings.
Yeah.
Mental well-being is our cognitive ability.
Oh, okay.
So our ability to concentrate. Our ability to make a judgment.
But they're very connected.
And they're very linked.
Connected as well, isn't it? Yeah, it's all connected.
I often talk about a triangle. I always say our well-being, and it's not me. This is Warwick Edinburgh University's
I'll write this down in a minute.
Definition of well-being.
Yeah.
They depict well-being in the form of a triangle. And at the base of the triangle is your physical health.
Yeah.
The next layer up is your emotional health. The next layer up is your mental health. And then they talk about at the apex of the triangle, your spiritual health or a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in your life. And the reason they depict it in a triangle is because if you're not physically healthy, that impacts how you feel emotionally.
Yeah.
Think of a time when you are very anxious. That impacts your cognitive abilities.
Yes, it did for you.
And it did.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can't even think about a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning. So we began to play with this concept of energy and well-being. And so as a result of my crucible moment in life, I then really got into, you know, if we were going to go down this route of well-being and talk more about it in the organization and drive it in terms of enhancing the energy of our people, we had to ensure that people felt comfortable to talk about their mental and emotional health.
That's the hardest bit, though, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I spent 18 months with a guy called Tim Munden, who was the head of HR in the UK business, and we piloted a piece of work over 18 months.
In the UK?
In the UK.
Oh, excellent.
Around
excellent.
Addressing stigma of mental ill health in Unilever. And developed a framework and an approach. And after about 18 months, we saw an amazing number of people beginning to put their hands up, ask for help early. And I thought to myself, you know what? I've learned something now. I've really learned something. I'm going to take this work to the world. And I then left. And I've
this
been
is
on
what
that
you
journey.
Now do. Yeah, I am definitely going to come back to that. But what I'd like to understand is you went back to work. You did an awful lot of stuff at work about energy. You got this new role. What did you do during that period about your own health? Because it's not just about going for a run late at night, is it? You know, there's a hell of a lot more to it. And I mean, I have, I don't know, there's 20 things that I do, give or take.
Yeah.
And I try to do them every day.
Yeah.
You know, and they're tiny by comparison in terms of time.
Yeah.
But they don't half make a difference collectively.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how did you get yourself up that triangle, that pyramid to the top? What did you do for yourself, basically?
So I'm going to leave you with a little acronym. And the acronym is called CAN DO. I saw this on a wall somewhere.
That's not an acronym. That's two words.
CAN DO. One word. CAN DO.
Is
all right?
Is it one word?
No. It is two words, but this acronym.
This is a CAN DO. Okay.
It's CAN DO.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
I want the listeners. It's easy to remember. CAN DO. And the C in CAN DO stands for connection. I will find 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 minutes every single day to do some connection.
You still do that?
Absolutely. With a member of my family, with a friend, or with nature.
Ah, yes. Because when you said connection, I instantly thought about connecting with your body, actually. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's about the outside world.
The outside world,
and
nature,
and
friends, family.
Yeah, one of the things I do is I try to spend some time in a green space every day. That's it. But connection with family is fundamental.
And connection is a critical driver of our emotional health. So if you think about lockdown, when we could not connect with loved ones and people that we loved and see them and hug them, people felt anxious. We had higher levels of depression, et cetera, et cetera. So I will find 5-10 minutes every single day to do some connection. The A in CAN DO stands for be active.
Yep. Exercise, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I will find 30 minutes every single day to be active. There's no way as I was getting on a tube from Waterloo Station to the studio today, I was going to ride my bike. 30 minutes on my bicycle, 30 minutes back there. I've got my 30 minutes of being active.
Do you do that every day?
Every single day. I'll swim, I'll ride my bike, or I'll go for a jog. But I will find 30 minutes every single day to be active. Or just go for a walk around the block.
Yeah.
The N in CAN DO stands for just try and be nice to somebody.
Oh, God. My watchword is, I heard Hanks, what's his name, Hanks? Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Say he was on Graham Norton.
Norton.
Christ, I can't remember names all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And he ended the show by just saying, be kind, be kind, be kind. And I thought, bloody hell, that's just absolutely terrific.
30 seconds to be nice to somebody.
It's not even that, is it? It's not even that. It's like holding a door for somebody.
Exactly. Helping an old man across the road.
Yeah, or saying thank you when they let you through.
Exactly.
You know, Christ, it's easy.
Exactly.
But doesn't it make you feel good?
A sense of purpose, sense of meaning.
Yeah.
So that's the N in CAN DO.
Yeah.
The D stands for discover, which is about being curious. And the more we try and be curious, we're using our minds during the course of a day. That's why I think work's so good for us. It's because we can be curious. We can learn something new. It's good for our neural pathways. It's good for our mental health. So that's the D.
Yeah.
And then the O. And Chaz, this is my biggest challenge in Can Do.
Go on then.
It's learning to just observe. What do I mean by that? The stroke the cat moment, where you just do nothing for 5 minutes every 2 hours.
But what you say doing that, does that physically doing nothing?
Absolutely. So let me tell you what it is. It's a stroke the cat moment where you actually do nothing for 5 minutes every 2 hours.
Including no thinking.
No. You could put some music in your ears and listen to music, or you could listen to a podcast, or you could just stand there and practice some breathing exercises for 5 minutes, or you could do a bit of mindfulness, or you could just sit outside and do nothing. Do nothing.
Oh, God, you see, I get twitchy though.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. And you know what's happened to us humans?
No, you're telling me off.
No, but you know what's happened to us human beings?
Yeah.
We have got so good at getting anxious when we do nothing.
Yeah, I'm honestly watching the telly and it's shit, right?
Yeah.
And it's a drama and I think, oh, for God's sake, you know, this isn't real, obviously. And before you know it, I'm picking up a paper. I'll be reading some questions that I've put together for this conversation. I mean, why am I doing that?
And what I say to people, particularly in the workplace, is every 2 hours, find those 5 minutes to do nothing. Because you know what it's like. You were in a big job in an important organization, and you go from meeting to meeting to meeting, and every single meeting there's a bit of a stressor here and a stressor there. And it's a bit like during the course of the day, the bucket is just filling with water and you get to the end of the day and it overflows.
Yeah. Don't you feel guilty doing nothing?
Yes, you do. But why? Why have we learned to feel guilty by doing nothing?
I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that, because I do feel guilty. I feel like I should be doing something.
No,
I should be learning something.
No.
I should be, you know, it's called practicing my art, even though I don't really do
Chaz,
it.
Chaz, it's called recovery. Now, Can Do says observe. Learn to just observe, all right? Another word for it would be recovery. And you know what? Athletes do it so well.
Yeah, they do.
Athletes train hard, but they are as disciplined around their recovery as they are their training.
Well, Steve Redgrave, the rower,
yeah,
right? He trained for however many years, got so many Olympic medals. I think he spent a year and a half training down.
Yeah.
So,
but also, I mean, when you're going to run a marathon, the week before, you begin to taper.
Yeah.
You stop doing any running.
Yeah.
2 or 3 days before.
And you don't just suddenly stop.
Yeah.
You
taper. Yeah. It's called taper.
You go down and you do less and less and less in the way that you built up. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, and it's hard. I said to you, it's my biggest challenge. Try 5 minutes. You know how hard it is to not pick up that phone to look at an email, a tweet, something on Instagram or Facebook or an email. You know, just learn to do nothing for five minutes.
I despair of the young, you know, with their phones.
Yeah,
you mentioned phones.
Exactly. That's what worries me so much about young people.
It really, really, really worries me. Hey. You know, you see kids walking down the street with their face in the phone. And they almost bump into you. Because
exactly.
And I thought, for Christ's sake, look around you.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
So I now am very, very disciplined. My crucible moment in life taught me one of the insights, or one of the lessons, was that the most valuable thing that I have in my life, the most valuable, is my well-being, physically, mentally, emotionally. It's the most valuable thing.
Yeah.
There's nothing more valuable. And so therefore, I have a mindset which says, I will prioritize it. And then people say to me, so I'll spend 60 to 90 minutes on Can Do every day. And people say, where do you get 60 minutes from? I say, they're 1,440 minutes in a day. 1,440
yeah, exactly.
minutes in a day.
Exactly.
Haven't you got 60 for yourself? And if you can't find 60,
do 30.
Do 30.
Do 10.
Start with 15 or 10.
Yeah.
But protect the most valuable thing you have in your life.
Yeah, and we don't do that, do we? No.
We don't.
Do you think... I mean, there's a worry for me about the young in business, particularly, because first of all, trying to get over the stigma of actually putting your hand up to say you've got an issue, but then the potential consequences of doing that, which are either you get sidelined at best, your career is potentially compromised, you might be looking after your can-do stuff, but how can we give people more permission to say stuff at work and say I've got a problem, and this I'm beginning to get onto the stuff that you do now, because you are absolutely passionate about and you found your purpose, haven't you?
Yeah, look, I think the first thing that I would say is that I think young people today are far more open about.
Yes, they are.
About how they feel.
Yeah. I'm a post-war baby, so, you know, my dad went through the war, didn't talk about anything until the day he died, frankly. And I found all sorts of stuff when I went through his trunk.
Yeah. And what gives me hope is that those young people will one day be leaders of big organizations one day, and this stuff will be okay to talk about.
Yeah. There's it's a generational thing, isn't it? And possibly two generations, actually.
But I think there is still that reality of whether they would talk at work, especially if they're a young graduate or their first management job and they're very ambitious and now they're struggling. Would they really
competitive?
Would they really, really put their hand up? And I think what we need is in organizations more and more is we need far more education across a business around mental health, mental ill health. Every single person should get some training.
Because the chances are every single person is going to have an issue.
Severe, or, as you say, is going to be touched by something, by it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody.
You cannot not be touched by it these days.
Exactly. And, you know, often, you know, we used to have this conversation in Unilever about should we make it obligatory? You know, every single person. Because when it comes to safety, you know, it's obligatory.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to get
safety.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why don't we want to keep people emotionally and mentally safe at work as well?
Yeah.
So, and the second,
because they get driven, don't they? They get. I mean, they take on a lot of these things because they don't want to say no to because they might be seen to be weak, and they're driven people anyway. But then, you always are. You know, if you want something done, you ask a busy person. Well, that isn't actually the person you should ask.
I know. But you know, the code of business principles. Everybody had to get training on code of business principles. You know, so let's make it obligatory in every single organization around the world that there'll be some training around mental health. I mean, the other thing that I think we need to bear in mind, it's a bit of a tangent because I'm going to deal with the stigma. I'm dealing with the stigma piece.
No,
and training for me
on,
is really
on.
Important. But Chaz, I think young people today also are far more discerning about the organization they're going to join.
Yes.
And they, the really talented ones, will ask you questions around what is your well-being strategy?
Yes.
What is your approach to the environment?
Yes.
What is your
approach
to this?
That latter,
what is
your,
you know? And they are going to choose those organizations where they feel that there is a serious attempt to enhance the well-being of their people. And there are resources in place and they've dealt with the stigma of mental ill health in their workplaces.
And it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. And therefore it is okay to not be okay.
Yeah. You've talked about capitalism 2.0, haven't you, in some of your talks. And I was aware of capitalism 1.0, obviously, because I'm a product of it.
Yeah. You know, and a finance guy.
And a finance guy. Yeah, Christ, if that's not capitalism, I don't know, is there capitalism 0.0?
Yeah, in a corporate. A finance guy in a corporate.
Jesus Christ, yeah, we're doomed.
Yeah.
2.0 is about companies being in that space, isn't it?
Yes.
About sustainability, mental well-being, overall well-being.
Yes.
But you see, my experience is at a PLC board level, and I'm sure you've been into PLC board levels.
Yeah.
And you get some pretty horrible people at these places.
Yeah, you do. Narcissistic gits is what I call them.
Yeah, I'd go probably a bit stronger than that.
Right.
Fucking bullies,
actually.
Yeah. And it's okay to say that word.
Yeah.
And I got bullied because, you know, the finance guy gets questioned about all the numbers.
Yeah.
It's the one who supposedly has all the answers, you know, and you get beaten up. And my switch goes off and I just disappear into a black hole. So you must have seen that type of behavior as well. And do you think that puts people off wanting to get to the top? Or do you think that
Absolutely.
They say,
Definitely.
That's the way I get to the top is to behave like that?
No. I think the younger generation today, Chaz, they've seen what the workplace has done to their father, their mother, the relationship. I think they're looking for something different.
Yeah.
I think they're looking for something different.
That's so refreshing that. You mentioned the word hope earlier.
Yeah.
That's just suddenly given me hope for the future.
They're looking for something different.
Where do you think shareholders are on that? Because they, at the end of the day, right, and I've got an investment analyst coming on a bit later on, who used to be the in-house broker for Superdry. Where do you think they are on the... that agenda in terms of the companies that they invest in? Do they say, right, it's just that they're doing that tick, 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 but actually I'm much more interested in financial returns, which drives the bullying, competitive capitalism 1.0 agenda, or do you think they are genuinely interested in companies that do it?
I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think there's some out there that are genuinely interested, and there are others that are just playing the good old game of short-termism.
Yeah,
I think ESG has had a, you know, the whole ESG drive, you know, and seeing some organizations falter and disappear because of poor practices and behaviors and narcissistic leaders, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the jury's still out on that.
Yeah.
I think the jury's still out.
I think you're right. I think, I mean, this is a movement, if you want to call it that will, has got a few years left to run. So
can I come back to the stigma piece
course,
and just
of course.
Finish that?
No, please do.
So I think, so one, you've got training in place. You're educating every single person in your workforce. I think the second bit that you're doing is you are campaigning. You are raising the awareness two or three times a year with campaigns across the organization, which is kind of saying, you know what, it's okay not to be okay. Or, by the way, mental health is a good thing to have, and this is how you should maintain good mental health.
It's part of you, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're all mental.
Yeah.
We're all mental.
I know. I've heard you say that before as
well.
We're
all emotional.
That's great. Yes, we are.
We're all emotional. We're all mental. We're all physical.
Yes, we are.
We're all, and people would say we're spiritual as well, you know. So
I think maybe we are in a way.
Yeah. So you've got the education piece. You've got the campaigning piece. And on the campaigning piece, the point I want to make here is I want us to start thinking about a more positive brand around mental health. Brand mental health is the most damaged brand I've ever
come across. It's terrible, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you hear the word mental health, people immediately go to illness. They go to depression, anxiety, bipolar. The images you see is somebody in a mental asylum, a black and white photograph
of
somebody
with
their hands in their head. If I walk into a Nike store in Regent Street, I mean, what do I see? Chiseled whippets all over the walls. People with beautiful bodies.
You.
Hey, me. Yeah,
I mean,
you as well.
You
as well. You know, chiseled whippets. And you kind of think to yourself, you know what, I'd love a body like that. And you go and buy a pair of running shoes. When it comes to mental health, I see black and white photographs with people in their hands and their heads. I mean, how can we make it inspirational and aspirational to look after your mental health? So I think there's a campaigning piece in organizations. And then finally, and the most powerful, Chaz, the most powerful, in normalizing and actually creating role models for these young people, which kind of says, you know what, you can struggle and you can still be successful. And that is storytelling. And we need more and more senior people.
You do a lot of that, don't you?
Yeah, I tell my story all the time. But we need more and more. You know, that was one of the things I did in Unilever, in catalyzing all of this. I shared my story. And then others started sharing their stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the more stories we can get out there and vertically across the organization. You know, yes, it's wonderful that we've got celebrities and we've got sportsmen and we've got all these people starting to talk about and politicians. But I think we need more and more senior leaders in organizations to be sharing their stories.
Do you remember plastic bags?
Yes.
The plastic bags from shops.
Yes.
And the government had a very, very, very simple intervention. It says, right, from now on they cost 10p.
Right.
Right?
And
it went down by 90%.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be good if the chief executive of a FTSE 100 company put their hand up and says, I'm struggling.
Yeah.
But I've hardly seen anybody at that level come out. And they must be there.
I mean, we'll look at the guy at Lloyd's.
Yes, Antonio, I can't remember his name.
It took him ages to come out.
It did.
It took him ages.
Yeah.
He eventually did.
Yeah.
But you know, but not all of these CEOs also have had crucible moments, okay? But they have been touched by depression, and they should share that story of how they've been touched.
Yes.
Now, they need to get the right permissions from the people that they're going to talk about, but just share, you know, I mean, I'll give you a great example. In Unilever, we had a chief scientist, right? And one day, he came into the office, and he wrote a blog to his 3,000 scientists around the Unilever world, and he titled the blog, "What is it like to be the father of a daughter who suffers from general anxiety disorder?" Now, he got his daughter's permission, he got his wife's permission, he got some of her friends' permission.
I bet the response was fantastic, wasn't
it? I mean, so it wasn't that he had this his own crucible moment around depression, but he wrote about what it's like to be the father of a daughter who struggles with general anxiety disorder. Do you know the scientist in Bangalore? She knew she could pick up the phone and talk to him because he would have a compassionate relationship. So I think we need more of that, that kind of storytelling as we normalize this conversation.
Because
and also
it does normalize it.
But also, you also want to create some role models. you know, you want these young people to see that, you know, a senior leader in the organization has struggled or has a compassionate relation to this and has still been successful.
Yes.
And that we need to see more of that.
Yeah. I use this example a lot, actually, but you remember, I don't know if you remember Fernando Torres, who used to play
for
Liverpool.
Yes.
And he was brilliant.
Yes. And then he went to Chelsea.
And he was crap.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. He didn't turn into a bad footballer overnight. What happened was the environment that he was in and the structure, the support structure, wasn't suited to him.
Yeah.
And so he ended up, I think he's gone to Atletico Madrid, or he did, he's probably retired now.
Yeah, I think
now,
he's finished now.
But it just needs people to realise that it's not you. Yeah. It's not you, it's that where you are that is causing you an issue. And then, so put your hand up.
Yeah.
But what about just at board meetings where you see, or senior executive meetings, where you see bad behaviour, how often does it get called out? In my experience, never. I've never seen it called out.
Yeah, I've very, very seldom. I mean, Professor Margaret Hefferman, she talks about willful blindness. You know, she's a professor at Bath University. How much willful blindness is there in organizations today?
Well, a lot of the people are cowards, actually, because they're thinking, oh, thank God he's having a go at them and not me.
Yeah.
I've got the same issues, but I wouldn't have done it quite like, you know.
But, you know, Chaz, if I think of the 9 or 10 years I've been on the road and I've been into C-suites and executive team sessions, you know, I can probably count on one hand where there is a disinterest in what I've got to say. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
It's been amazing.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I can't believe it, actually. Honestly, it's been fantastic talking to you, Jeff. And that's a fabulous note to end on. Is that people don't dismiss it when they hear the storytelling. And I've taken a lot out of our conversation today.
Wonderful,
and
thank you.
It's been really, really good having you on. And I've got Can Do written down. Well, I haven't got it written down, but I will do in a minute.
Yeah.
But I'd love to carry on the conversation because actually on FUBAR, on Just Not Good Enough,
let's do it.
If we can, because there's so much more that I think you've got to offer in terms of work that you're doing now.
Let's do it.
And the people that you're meeting and the things that you're getting involved in. And basically, it's only a bike ride away, isn't it?
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.